that is really a mid-century faith in the power of a series of pharmaceutical interventions. And antibiotics are the most obvious example, where the idea was these drugs are so powerful they will work in anyone, regardless of individual detail. You don't need to understand the individual, you just need to get their diagnosis right. And if you have the right diagnosis, we have the right technology, and you can have these universalized standard medicines. And it's not a coincidence that one of the first places that picks up these racial variations in drug response was isoniazid. It was the first outpatient treatment of tuberculosis. It was one of the first drugs picked up by WHO in the late 1940s, early 1950s for global treatment campaigns. They take isoniazid in 52 worldwide to try to treat populations to eradicate tuberculosis. And when you take a drug global on that way, you realize that different people responded differently. And they realized there was a racial structure to the side effects. They saw one group of population would get liver toxicity, another population got peripheral neuropathies. And so now we're in this era where, you know, officially we're still in this era of highly powerful standardized medicines that should work for everyone. But it's trying to reconcile the much longer, the prior sensitivity to individual variation that has been part of medical practice for thousands of years. There are pockets of places in medicine before pharmacogenetics where personalization was more active. The most obvious case is pediatrics. Pediatrics is the one place in medicine that does weight-based dosing up until a point. And so your comment that, you know, you're bigger guys, shouldn't you get a higher dose? Well, of course you should, but so many pediatricians should bother to take those factors into consideration. And the idea is, you know, adults are similar enough, even though you look in this room and there's probably not an order of magnitude variation in weight, but some people like to weigh twice as much as other people do. Shouldn't you have twice the dose? Doctors have dismissed that, and since most drugs have a pretty big margin of error, you can get away with not considering weight. There are certain drugs, and especially chemotherapy agents, where there's a much thinner line between therapeutic and toxic. And there they will do careful calculations based on body surface area before dosing you with drugs. And so there are some areas where you'll do that. Or geriatrics is the other place. There's recognition that once you're old enough, your liver and your kidneys don't work as well as they used to, and you have to dose appropriately for fear of causing drug toxicity in those populations. Well, the question is, well, how far should you generalize that into the world of the 70-kilogram adult male typical patient? And this then becomes the area where you see a very complicated nexus of scientific, commercial, and regulatory claims getting made. So for whatever its merits, you know, BIDL was an attempt to say you need to treat one class of patients based on skin color differently from another class of patients. I'd mentioned that warfarin, a widely used blood thinner, does a very narrow therapeutic window, very easy to get toxic side effects from it. It's been an area of great pharmacogenetic interest. And again, a case where it's really hard to understand the intents of the people involved. So most drugs are metabolized by dozens, if not scores, of enzymes. But because it's convenient, researchers have focused on this one small set of P450 enzymes. So they single out this one enzyme. I think for warfarin, it's P453A4, I think, I'm not certain, that's important. So they create a gene test for that. And they show that if you stratify your patients when you initiate Coumadin based on this gene test, you can get them to a therapeutic dose more quickly. You know, it's like 7 days versus 9 days sort of difference. They have never shown that it actually improves patient outcomes. They've just shown that using the gene test to inform your initial dose gets you to the desired level more quickly than otherwise. And they were able to convince the FDA that that was worth doing. So what the FDA has essentially done is put a black box on Coumadin, saying that if you have not gotten this gene test before prescribing Coumadin, you're out of the standard of care. And this has really freaked out physicians who have been using Coumadin for decades, feel very comfortable using Coumadin, and don't want to have to get a $1,000 gene test every time they initiate Coumadin. But if they don't do it now, and their patient falls, hits their head, and has a bleed, then they have no defense in a lawsuit. They'll say, look, the FDA has said the standard of care is X, you did not do that. Settle the case before it goes to trial. And so that's a case where someone convinced the FDA to intervene in this way, which has totally tied the hands of practicing physicians. You know, they may be able to dodge the bullet because now there's a new drug that has been released supposedly to replace warfarin, And that's a different issue. That's using a very expensive brand name drug to replace a very cheap generic drug. And there's different sets of competing baggage about those two drugs. So it'll continue to be a very actively debated area going forward.
Is it a genetic test or an enzyme test?
It's a genetic test. It's one of these things where the technology is changing. It's a single allele variant study. You're like, why would you do a single allele variant study? You can do a 500 SNP affymetric chip. They're cheap. The problem is the knowledge doesn't exist to interpret those chips in most clinical scenarios.
Yeah. One of the things that pharmacogenetics is trying to solve is the enormity of the deaths from adverse drug reactions. The estimates go really very, very high. And the whole way they systematize drug testing, to begin with, you use genetically identical animals, for one thing. Then when you get past that stage, you go to a clinical trial, and maybe you have 1,000 people if you have a fairly big trial, and there's no genetic diversity in those groups. There's no demand for genetic diversity. Then once the drug is accepted, we don't have a systematic way to evaluate adverse drug reactions. There's no mandatory requirement that physicians have to post an adverse drug reaction. And even if they do, nobody studies them. Nobody, in Japan, you were required as a physician to post an adverse drug reaction. So the whole system is really designed against identifying the adverse drug reactions. It becomes too late. Companies usually put a couple of $1 billion set aside for all the litigation. And then by that time, they've had 4 or 5 years of $1 billion drug sales. It seems to me that the personalized medicine ought to be built into the testing programs and to the adverse drug testing.
So people would say yes. The question is, what's the best way to do that? And is genetics the answer? So the empirical question, what percent... they'll say 100,000 deaths a year from adverse drug reactions or from medical errors, most of which are drug reactions. What percentage of those are relevant for pharmacogenetics? The data doesn't exist to answer that question. I would say it's a tiny percent, based on my own experience with drug errors. It's usually a mistake that's made directly by a physician or a nurse or a pharmacist. You could likely make the case that far more adverse outcomes, not meaning complications, but meaning an outcome less than the ideal outcome, far more adverse outcomes are caused by noncompliance. Go to any of the emergency rooms in Boston and you'll find loads of people coming in with the complications of diabetes and hypertension, all of which are wholly preventable if the patient and the doctor were able to figure out an appropriate regimen for them. So if you wanted to get rid of all of the bad outcomes related to pharmaceutical care, should you invest the energy and attention in these genetic issues, or should you look elsewhere? I can tell you what the answer is going to be. The answer is going to be on genetics. And there'll be increasing pressure to do genotyping of patients up front with the expectation that will control these adverse effects. You'll get drug companies to buy into this by saying, well, look, your drugs that are falling out of the pipeline because of complications will now be resuscitated because you'll find out the subset of patients for whom they can be safe and effective. And there are a series of prominent examples from that in the oncology literature. But I don't think that's going to solve the problem. I think people are still going to have suboptimal outcomes because of human error, because of system error, because of noncompliance and everything else that happens.
I want to pick up on that remark made about the thousands of years of personalization in medicine. I think you bear in mind that medicine involves not just professionals in our modern sense. The tradition of the witch, men and the witch women, herbalists, male and female, midwives, and over the centuries, these people were gradually pushed out of the profession. For example, women were largely pushed out by the whole witchcraft hysteria, which served to marginalize. And then when medicine was professionalized, it became a male profession, and women had to fight for the right to get back to even delivery processes. So this is a long history here. But even, I probably always put it here, I even remember medicine as practiced in the United States from 30 years on. I had a personal physician in the 30s, just to mention two physicians, I had a personal physician in the 30s. He was Jewish, he had to go to Vienna to get his medical training, but that meant he knew about psychoanalysis. And looking back, I can understand, he understood the importance of transference in establishing a relationship with a patient. And that's a psychological fact. And secondly, the physician I had when we first came to Boston in the 60s, he'd been here, he brought up, he went back even older than I was. But he told me the first thing he did with any new patient was to spend 1 hour with that patient talking. Because in his estimation, 80% of the influence a physician had on a patient was psychological. And until you establish that bond of trust and because it's a psychological relationship, the rest was, you know, going to go by the way. Now that has been lost, clearly. And the fact that the first thing that comes to mind when we talk about personalization is what kind of drugs you're going to personalize rather than what kind of relation you're going to personalize shows already what we've lost. And I think we've got to kind of fight to get that back. I think that it's no accident, this is part of the whole commodification. The fact that capital social relations take over everything, they're taking over medicine, they're taking over education now. You know, this goes about the for-profit colleges, for example. You see this happen everywhere, but unless we fight back against this, we're going down and just slowly slope further and further.
Worse, not better. There's a series of interesting pieces about that. So psychiatrists would say, well, of all the specialties of medicine, they're the ones who are best at personalizing medicine for various historical reasons. But they're also, I think, the group that has been most enthusiastic about pharmacogenetics, I think because they have the least understanding of the disease that they're treating and they have the least effective medications. And so they're desperate for anything that might possibly give a shred of efficacy to their practice. One thing I wonder about, you know, I say that as a board-certified psychiatrist. One thing I wonder about, I don't think this is actually true, but you could tell a good conspiracy theory here. This is in reference to talking about people getting forced out. One thing that's going to happen as pharmacogenetics gets argued as being important for clinical practice is it will allow physicians to continue to make the argument that prescribing is a highly expert skill. And again, psychiatrists are the ones who are dealing with this the most. So every so often, the state will try to pass a ballot initiative or a referendum allowing psychologists the ability to prescribe psychiatric medications. And the response of psychiatrists is always the same, that prescribing a medication is an act of medicine. You can't just be trained as a psychologist and understand the full body-wide effect of these medications and the effects of other illnesses. Only a physician knows enough to use these drugs safely. Pharmacogenetics is a total gift to that argument. By saying, you know, this is so complicated, not only do you need to understand the organ being treated, but you have to have this esoteric knowledge of genetics if you're going to prescribe effectively. So I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see, if pharmacogenetics does catch on, you'll start to see that deployed in these arguments to protect professional privilege. And I was amazed recently, there's a debate now, you know, that psychiatrists are issuing the DSM-5, so the latest revision of their manual. And they're trying to make the claim that only psychiatrists are allowed to issue diagnoses based on that. They're trying to prevent psychologists and social workers even from using the DSM on the grounds that these are medical diagnoses that can only be given by physicians. And so they're active areas where they're trying to defend privilege. I suspect pharmacogenetics will be a useful tool of that effort. I don't think that's what's driving that, but I think that will be a consequence of this.
I was thinking primarily about primary care physicians. And what primary care the physician has given an hour to the patient, to the person who you find that on but I hope as a psychiatrist, and you give an hour to your patient if you're doing it the way you describe
it. It varies on mode of practice. Their primary care physicians in Boston will give you an hour. You have to pay them a $10,000 annual retainer. But then you'll get your hour. That's the old-fashioned personalization. And they likely have much better outcomes, but at high financial cost.
Mm-hmm. But you can buy personalization.
Well,
secondly, I have another name for that sort of commercial personalization.
I just wanted to at least give people the opportunity to open questions to any of our speakers today. So I don't know if the speakers want to come forward or people have exhausted their questions for the day, but at least it could be an opportunity if anybody has something they want to recall from the morning. Or
I just want to recall by listening to this book. It's a book I recommend, The Dependent Gene, The Fallacy of Nature versus Nurture by David Moore. It wasn't on that team, that's another one.
Okay, all right. Well, let's thank all of